listening to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio. Hey guys, welcome to the Dolcezza Sherber Experience. We are live from the Line Hotel. This is Violeta, and I'm here with
Rob Duncan, Dolcezza Gelato as well.
We make gelato in Washington, D.C. We have 8 locations, and we have a factory in Northeast D.C. where we make small batch gelato every day. Today, we are here with activist and organizer Adam Eidinger. Adam has dedicated much of his life to advance the legalization of marijuana and has helped pass Initiative 71, which legalized cannabis in D.C. in 2015. So I want to start there, but we can talk about so many things because you're involved in so many things, Adam. So thank you so much for being here.
Philosophical gadfly here.
That's what Rob calls you.
Yeah, you are like the quintessential gadfly.
Thanks.
Oh, 100%.
I mean, gadfly sometimes is used to just dismiss someone.
I don't mean it like that at all. It's just like put the finger in your fucking face and wag it, you know, when whatever's going on. I think it's important to have those characters to bring light to whatever the weasels are up to.
So Adam, I want to ask you about Initiative 71, and the District of Columbia has one of the most tangled marijuana legalization efforts in the country. Mm-hmm. It allows the residents to possess cannabis, grow plants, and gift up to 1 ounce of cannabis to anyone 21 and older, but you can't buy it or sell it, and which it means that D.C. cannot tax or regulate the marijuana its voters legalize. And this was thanks to Congressman Andy Harris. And you have relocated to Maryland in order to help and seat Congressman
good friend,
Andy
right?
Harris.
Andy is your good friend?
So how is that going, Adam?
Well, I've been renting a house in Salisbury, Maryland since April. We've formed a group called MDMJ. You can look us up at mdmj.org. It really was sort of, the idea was to go to a red district and not just any red district, but the one that is preventing D.C. from writing its own laws when it comes to marijuana reform. Andy Harris introduced a rider to the D.C. budget shortly after Initiative 71 had passed and was already ratified by the Board of Elections and transmitted to Congress. And it basically was the law, but it froze things in time from that moment, and it prevents our 13 D.C. council members and the mayor from introducing and authoring any new marijuana reform legislation. Now, we could not put tax and regulate. We couldn't put stores on the ballot because of the way our ballot laws are structured. It has to be rights-based. So we gave people the rights to grow in their home, the right to possess 2 ounces, the right to share. Not gift for donation, by the way. the right to, you know, keep everything you grow in your home. You can walk out of your house, you know, with 2 ounces. But and the 6 plant rule is really per person, no more than 2 people per household. That's 12 plants. These were all rights. These don't require any government regulation. If you go beyond this, if you grow more plants, if you've got more marijuana, if you're selling it, you're still a criminal in the District of Columbia. But we think that's wrong, too. We think there should be lawful ways for people to do this. And we expected the D.C. Council to write those laws, and they didn't get to write those laws because of Andy Harris. So that's why I moved to Andy Harris's district, because, you know, after confronting him shortly afterwards at a town hall meeting in his district and saying, why are you messing with D.C.? I mean, you're 100 miles away on the Eastern Shore. This is a Republican area. We're a 90% Democratic registered town. You know, Donald Trump got 4% of the vote here, and you support Trump. I mean, what gives you? What gives? You know, and I mean, you don't respect us. And he says, Article 1. Read it, Adam. Article 1, U.S. Constitution, talks about the district is under the purview of the federal government, the whole district. So the Home Rule Act, which gives us ballot initiatives, which gives us the mayor, which gives us this D.C. council, it's very weak in many respects. So if any congressman has a whim, they can, like, you know, just, oh, we're just going to change the laws for 700,000 people, 500,000 voters, you know. So we started protesting him, and we started. I even backed a Republican in 2016 against him in the primary because I figured, well, it's a Republican district. I got to go, you know, but it didn't work. So after many years of being told to my face, like, if you don't like it, move to a state, Adam. You don't like D.C., move somewhere else. I'm like, I've lived here most of my life. You know, I'm 45, and you're telling me I should just move to another place. You know, I want to say F you. Can I say it here?
Oh, yeah.
Uncensored. I would say, fuck you, you know. It's like, how dare you? And anyway... So this occurred to me, I should just take him up on his offer and move to his backyard, like move as close to him as I can. And then I thought about it some more. I'm like, you know, I want to move to a place that I like. I like the Eastern Shore a lot. Salisbury is actually a very diverse community. It's about 50% African-American. Lots of Democrats out there, even though it's a red district overall. This is like kind of a Democratic bastion. So let's go out there and raise some hell and fire people up. And what we found there were people living in the dark ages, marijuana-wise. I mean, scared to death to smoke marijuana. We were knocking on doors to get energized voters in the Democratic primary. And we had this whole canvas of a dozen cannabis activists from D.C. who are out there, like, waking everyone up. You shouldn't be going to jail for this anymore. It was beautiful, actually. It was really very important work for me on a personal level. But going door to door, I met people who said, I don't smoke weed because... they can smell it a block away, and they'll just come into your house and break it down. So I smoke hard drugs, you know, methamphetamine, because they can't smell it.
Doesn't smell.
Damn. And it was just like, this is Andy Harris's district. This is the world that he thinks is okay, you know. And we are like really doing the right thing in D.C. by reforming. We don't have a meth problem. Sure, there's people here who use meth, but we don't have the kind of problem that he has in his district. We don't have the opioid overdoses that he has. So that's why I moved there. And I have to say, I'm going to make some news on your show right now.
Dun, dun, dun.
Last Friday, I went down to the Board of Elections in D.C. And Monday this week. I went to the Board of Elections and I registered to vote in Ward 2, where I'm currently residing. Because I kind of, once the election was over and I voted out there against Andy Harris... and I voted in the primary. It was sort of like, well, I have to keep that house till April, but really, I'm here spending more of my time here. I'm working on another campaign, so I better switch back to D.C.
So you're back, being
so
a
I'm
DC
back.
Resident.
I was
welcome
a brief,
back, Adam.
It was a brief stint, and but we formed an organization that's lasting, and we are, and I'm very committed to people of Salisbury and the First District to. Seeing Andy Harris removed, he did win re-election.
But the problem is not him. It's basically D.C. statehood, right? I mean, that is the issue. It's not this
that
guy.
Allows.
It's that any guy can change things for voters here in D.C.
The lack of state rights here in D.C.
So that's something you're involved in as well, right?
Because
you're
years.
Involved in everything, Adam, by the way. I was researching for this interview.
There's so much material.
Why are you not fighting? Like, what do you do in your spare time? Do you watch Netflix?
Okay, so
after you go on, where do you come from? Why do you need to do this now?
I just get the money question out of the way. A lot of people like, where did you get your money from to do all this? You know, like that's a big. People always ask that.
They're like, oh, you're
like how are you doing this? How are you doing that? How did you go to Palestine? I work for a great company called Dr. Bronner's.
We love Dr. Bronner's.
Well, I used to get high and read the bars of soap. I mean, we would sit there around, seriously, like outside campfire and smoke a joint. And we would open the bar of soap and read his ravings and rantings. And they were brilliant back in the 80s
and 90s. He was a pioneer in marketing and you know, expressing a message through a private brand.
And hemp, bringing hemp oil soap. Yeah.
It was like he put his religion on the bottle and said, you know, Dr. Bronner is saying that we're all one, that we're all one earth, that, you know, and that we have transcendent unity and we need to recognize it. Like we're all part of the same family. And so he would drive this point home. He would say that like, it's just one spaceship and we're all on it, you know? And so he was really popular in the 60s with hippies. They made the soap popular. They were like, this guy's authentic.
And
he's
the families
a real
are still running the business, right?
Yeah. So then you get this family, you would think they're like billionaires by now because they've been selling soap for 50 years in the United States and stores all across America. They're not. They actually capped their pay at 5 times the lowest paid worker. So David Bronner, the CEO, Michael Bronner, the president, they are altruistic owners, and there's not a single person who works at the company who's making less than $50,000 a year right now. There's a lot of people in the company making between $70,000 and $100,000 a year, and there's even a whole bunch of people making $100,000 to $150,000 that are in the executive team. But it's not outrageous salaries for Southern California, where most people work, where the factory is. And then there's a team in D.C. that has been working on public affairs for many years. And we kind of split the public affairs office a few years ago. And a new office called Movement Media was created, headed by Ryan Fletcher. And I kind of broke off and created this thing called the Social Action Department of Dr. Bronner's. And that was just sort of formalizing what was already going on, which was like I was spending all my time doing sort of executing the will of David Bronner and Michael, really Michael and David's, you know, core political values that currently come from their grandfather. But this representing it here in Washington, because they're in California and they were like, hey, we really want to be represented here. So I think they're a great example of an altruistic company that like has a small presence in Washington permanently so we can do social justice work. And we've decided like if there's a group that's working, you know, in alignment with our values, myself, Nicholas Schiller, our entire department, which there's other people too, I'm not going to name them all, we'll actually just like all steer and work on that issue. And we're currently doing that on this thing called Save Our Vote. People can look it up at saveourvote.org. And so, but cannabis is at the center of it all. And you know what's weird? Like for Dr. Bronner's people who do work on cannabis, and we use a lot of hemp oil in our products, hemp is what brought everyone together. Like cannabis, it's what brought us together right now. I mean, like, it really brings people together. And
it's like breaking bread. I always said that when a friend comes over and if you're smoking, then you kind of pull it out and you smoke. And then the conversation just kind of gets more animated or more interesting. Or maybe it just shuts down because the strain is so strong and everybody zones out. But it is something that's always been like breaking bread and sharing something that hopefully was grown by you. And
yeah, I like how you mentioned being grown by you, because that's what DC's initiative is. So that's what's so radical about it and so beautiful about it, is that it put home grow before marketing essentially to the masses.
Right.
And shouldn't it be that way? I mean,
100%. It should be sold at farmers markets eventually, yes. Right? Like you grow and you bring your stuff and share it with the others.
Yeah, one thing that I always say when I, you know, what's the technical term? I can't use gift anymore. I gift a piece of cannabis, a bud to somebody.
You gifted me cannabis today. This was not a trade.
Gifted each other cannabis. But the thing that I say to the people, and it's like, this cannabis right here, you go and have a great experience, headspace, but it's like it has dimensions to the experience that only I can get because I grew it. You know, and that whole thing of like taking ownership of your food or your cannabis or whatever it is that you use, if you actually make it or grow it, it adds to the experience that only you can get through conservation of energy. What goes in must come out, you know? And mm-hmm. It's really fascinating, that experience. If you are a head, a true head, you've got to grow because that's where it's at. The lights, the greater lights are in that, you know? And that's what it's all about to me.
For Rob. He spends a lot of time with the plants.
Oh, the plants are the most intelligent species on this planet. Fuck the fungi. Well, no. The fungi, you know, actually. The fungi fuck the animals. And
well, fungi are not plants.
No, I know. It's a different kingdom.
Different species.
Respect to the fungi. I mean, yeah. For God's sake. They're actually brilliant, you know? I mean, decomposers are the most green solution on this planet. But the plants are also mad props to the plants.
Definitely, which is something that, you know, we always talked about. You know, it's like the medical aspect or the healing aspect of cannabis, right? Mm-hmm. We love that, and there's a lot of people talking about that now. It's sort of, you know, everywhere. There's Sanjay Gupta, there's Michael Pollan, there's Andrew Weil, and all these mainstream cultural reference that talk about the power of plants, which I think is super powerful. And you're involving something called Catharsis on the Mall, right? Mm-hmm. And that's tell me a little bit about what it is.
We're going to go multi-directional.
Whoa, okay. Catharsis is a vigil for healing that takes place usually over 3 days straight. It's nonstop. starting like on a Friday afternoon and goes to like a Sunday afternoon. Although the people that set it up are there for a whole week. We have to be there 24 hours a day on the site. And this is right at the base of the Washington Monument, between the White House and the Washington Monument on the National Mall. It's this huge open area. You can see the horizon. You really can feel the presence of the earth. You know, you're on the earth. And I think we're creating practically a sacred space. I mean, like, I'm not as woo-woo a hippie as some folks I know on the West Coast are, or folks in D.C. even. But we really are, like, aligning with the placement of every object on the site to a center object, which in this case is called the temple. And inside that, people leave mementos, words. They write on it. You can, and then it's burned. And so the whole community participates in building this beautiful temple. We add to this temple. It's almost a memorial.
So it's a la Burning Man?
It's totally a la Burning Man. I'm a burner.
You're a burner. I've
been going for 12 years now. And okay. I've only missed a couple years in 12 years. So this is a big part of my life. And I probably think catharsis is the most important project I'm working on, and it's the most amazing community, and it's so open, it's radically inclusive. The 10 principles of Burning Man are the guiding principles of what we're doing, but officially it's a demonstration, and unlike Burning Man, there's no ticket. You just park your car and walk in. This is the way it should be. We have created a new model for community burns. I think there may have been some other examples of this in other parts of the country, but this happening on the National Mall in a high profile way, it's powerful. So the next one, just to sort of follow up on this, is May 4th, and it's moving to a warmer month. This will be after 4 years of burning in November, which I actually kind of like.
May the 4th be with you, man. That
yeah, maybe
purposely.
We're gonna have to have a whole Star Wars camp there.
Yeah, 100%. You will.
the theme by the trunk, which is kind of like the board of Catharsis. It's elected now by the community. I'm not on the trunk. I'm a roots member. I'm one of the founders, and we have an advisory role at this time, but we're not actually voting on the theme. But I can tell you, because I can gossip all I want about the theme, that it's probably going to be a theme that's focused on the environment. And the current Ethos, who's the executive producer of Catharsis, has already written a proposal, and it's sort of circulating, and it's called, the theme is One Earth. I mean, I like all one, you know, because that's Dr. Bronner's motto, but One Earth, because it's not just this, you know, carbon reduction and renewable energy and stuff. We're also, we don't want to stop talking about borders. We don't want to stop talking about human rights and peace. And we've been doing that a lot lately. The last Catharsis, I think, was more about that. The theme was called Healing from the American Dream. Healing from it.
From it. I love it.
It wasn't like, it was like the dream is what's killing us. Right. It's killing the planet. It's
the dream of consumerism makes you happy.
It's the dream too for so many people. And I feel like the super rich in our society have lost track of what it means to do. Why do you need billions? You know, why does anyone need billions?
It's unethical. I mean, it's,
yes.
Yeah.
And a lot of billionaires aren't giving away their wealth.
And they're
just accumulating
more.
They won't. Like our president, for instance.
Well, okay.
talking about
legalization of marijuana. I mean, this is an administration that is not going to advance any of that. I mean,
yeah, maybe, because you know what's advancing legalization of marijuana is the money, man. That's what's really advancing. I mean, you got grassroots like you. That's not that, but on the overall, I think the reason that it's not going to be stopped is
money. You got John
Boehner,
the speaker,
exactly,
former speaker, Republican speaker, out giving a lecture series. He's literally going town to town, raking in cash for Wall Street-backed, bank-backed firms that have almost no experience in cannabis, and they're just going out and buying up companies. And you know what? There is so much snake oil right now in the cannabis business world.
Gosh.
And even in Maryland, which has a medical program, which, we're the most restrictive, and we're doing such a good job regulating. Well, you know what? There's videos on the internet of employees spraying chemicals on the goddamn dispensary weed that they sell in Maryland. And they did it because they had massive cobwebs covering these plants. They all these plants, we can't throw them away. That's all our profit. So they literally like removed all the bugs, sprayed them with chemicals, washed these plants off. And it's all on video. It's all being circulated on the internet. There's no investigation going on at the highest levels. The governor's backers, it's their firms. I'm talking about Governor Hogan here that are behind this. And in District of Columbia, I think we have a little better situation. I actually don't have any evidence of this happening in D.C. And I know a lot of the dispensary and cultivation owners. But they should be selling to adults right now. They should be first in line. They should be they put a lot of money on the line to set up these businesses, and now they're barely surviving.
Because they don't have a market. Debt.
You know how much a bud tender makes? Minimum wage.
Yeah.
This is not. These aren't good jobs by and large. The owners are all in debt. What's going on? Why is it like this? It's because the government's over-regulating cannabis at every level, local level, federal level. They're not even recognizing it yet. It's still Schedule One. But at the local level, we are putting laws in place that are totally unnecessary. Every single business that exists right now that has a food license, that has an alcohol license, that has any kind of business license should be able to sell cannabis. It shouldn't be a special permit to sell. Now, granted, now we have these dispensaries and we have a cultivation center set up. I don't want them to be bankrupted by legalization. So we have to transition out of that. But the first step is give them the market for a couple years. The next step is give the market to businesses, like any business. This business, we're in the Line Hotel. There should be a dispensary
room
in here.
Room service to get a nice silver haze to go to sleep at night.
You can smoking
have
here.
Sex with your girlfriend in the room and the best sex you'll ever have, etc. Seriously, wake the fuck up, folks. You know what the thing is? For that reason, with the pesticides and the chemicals being sprayed, grow your fucking own. That's why. You don't have to worry about it. You can put whatever you want.
That's our point now, is that home grow is actually safer than what you'll
100%.
Buy. You know exactly what you're getting. And if, like my friend Dawn, whose daughter has serious epilepsy, was having seizures every day until she got CBD. But they're growing their own cannabis, her and her daughter, you know, who is young, I think 11 now. And their daughter is growing her own medicine. And you mentioned earlier about the benefits of producing your own thing. It's not just the financial savings. And there is a significant savings growing your own. I mean, it's like a 90% savings off of retail to grow it yourself. But the other savings is, you actually, the action of the work. The work is healing. Dr. Bronner would talk about,
of course,
go clean your kitchen next
anything
time you're depressed.
Anything can become a meditation. Yeah.
Go do your dishes. Go vacuum your house. You won't be depressed afterwards. Work makes you...
That's,
work
the, that's good. The problem. People are fucking lazy. So you know what that means?
They're
they'll
not
buy,
fucking lazy.
Yes,
they
don't are.
See, they've not
no.
been,
yes,
they haven't seen
are.
The light
yes,
yet.
We are.
I've met lazy people,
people
who then
me,
turn into hyper-productive people. I think
I think there is not an emphasis on the process. There is an emphasis on the result.
Lazy.
And people want instant
you know
results.
What? You know what?
But, and
you know
hard
what?
Work, it's a process.
It's hard to do hard work. It sucks to do hard work. But what you get from that is you get
maturity.
Self-respect, maturity. So
resilience.
If people weren't lazy, you know what you would be? You would not be a consumer of the message that was being beamed down from all high. And you would push back on everything that we're trying to be sold from a political ideology or a toothpaste. And if that was done by every single one of us as people, we wouldn't get the bullshit that we have now. It's on us. Mm-hmm. And it's hard work. And when you have a culture that definitely doesn't support it, it wants the uneducated, because you know why? Uneducated are the best consumers. You've got to get smart. You've got to push back on everything. And then, again, it is not easy. It's hard. I mean, it's a hard work, and that's the importance of a community, of your own experiences. But it's there's
right
a lot
the,
of...
You're right about education being like the whole thing, because I...
100%.
If there's no
it's
education, you're going to get getting bad politicians
know.
In office. You get... You know, bad
education
policies.
Education is the one thing that it can change this world.
And, there is no education, though. It's like vocational
training.
You have
to remember, this country, up until really the 1930s, we had vast numbers of people that were uneducated. And they were living in total poverty and squalor in the cities. I mean, you go to New York City in 1900, you had a million people living in just destitute poverty, like... 10 people to a tiny room sleeping on cots. And it was all about they were illiterate. They didn't have any skills they could market. The more we educate our people and the more skills we give them, the more they can... survive, I think, and thrive.
And contribute.
I don't want to survive. I want people to thrive, right, too. And that's another thing about cannabis. Like, I think people that are using cannabis and not alcohol to... And I'm not saying a drink every once in a while is a bad thing, but in fact, I do drink occasionally, but not to excess. Like, one or two drinks in a setting, and not every day in a row, even. So if people can, like, moderate their alcohol, incorporate more cannabis, I think you can thrive.
Yeah.
I think if you're taking CBD instead of the pharmaceuticals for your back pain, you're going to do better. It's just you have to be patient, and you need to incorporate stretching and
healthy eating, exercise,
and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So
being kind to one another.
So what cannabis is a wellness thing. It's not just a party thing. And legalization is, I would hope, will actually increase the wellness stuff.
I think it will, man. I think what's happening right now, you know, it's really interesting. The rise of all the female feminism, Me Too, this and that, the candidates, the rise of the female in general is the same thing, or is being, it's coming from the same thing as the legalization of cannabis. Mm-hmm. All the research that's going into psychedelics, MDMA, LSD, DMT.
Oh, we didn't talk about
psilocybin. Yeah.
I'd like to talk about that.
Let's go there with MAPS, and you, because you work with Doblin, right? Or something.
I've had the honor and privilege MDMA, to work with ecstasy. Rick Doblin since early 2000s, and a lot of different struggles. But Dr. Bronner's has provided a pledge of $5 million to MDMA research to bring it forward as a prescription for PTSD. And this isn't just like mild PTSD, but people who've tried other things, like untreatable PTSD, sort of the worst case scenario. There's a lot of interesting ways to look at this topic. I mean, for people who are not sure what we're talking about, MDMA, we're talking about the drug ecstasy. And it's not necessarily what you get on the street either, because that could be cut with fentanyl and other drugs, and you really are getting a cocktail of drugs, and it's not good. But pure MDMA with a, trained psychologist, psychiatrist nearby, who are there for talk therapy with MDMA, is actually showing tremendous results, like a 75% success or partial success rate. I've met multiple veterans who are now actually working on Capitol Hill to speed this process, or at least make sure that they're aware of it. John Lebecki is someone that comes to mind who works with MAPS. He had a traumatic brain injury. He was in combat for 12 years in multiple theaters. I mean, this guy had seen all kinds of stuff. And it finally caught up with him, and where he was could not sleep, had insomnia, his health was going down the drain. And, they tried all these drugs. They had him on tranquilizers, basically, at one point to get him to sleep. It was just really awful. And ultimately, he got MDMA in the first phase of these drug trials that we've been sponsoring, and he just cured, basically. I mean, he went back to normal. He was like, I feel like myself again. This has been years.
That's what people are experimenting. They are able to heal the trauma,
You look into the studies of the 60s, the 50s, and the 60s with LSD and the alcoholics and the recovery. Mm-hmm. Before it became illegal. The same kind of thing.
Before Nixon, basically.
The Controlled Substance Act.
For listeners, if you're curious more about this, I know we're going to move on, but it's maps.org, MAPS.org. Check it out. And
it's
a lot of the money is
Multidisciplinary
Association for Psychedelic Studies.
Yes, Rick Doblin.
And just to let everybody know, it's like $28 million price tag to legalize MDMA for prescription. And
they're in phase three.
It's not
fast
just
tracks,
being paid
right?
for by altruistic companies like Dr. Bronner's, but it's also a huge community fundraising effort, and there are actually thousands of people at this point who have donated to this already. So if you've ever used MDMA, maybe in a club setting, and it was great for you, let's decriminalize it at the very least for people who really need it, and stop putting them in jail and not make them risk jail to get it.
And these trials are done in UCLA, in Johns Hopkins. I mean,
NYU.
This is legitimate research.
And just touching on that, just through experience, and let's kind of read and study and follow this. It seems like what's happening with all these experiences with the psychedelics, although MDMA, I don't think technically would be a psychedelic-like LSD, DMT, psilocybin.
It is a psychedelic.
So it is psychedelic.
So is cannabis, by the way.
Each into their own. Yeah, it's true. It's true. I mean, I guess you just got to get the right dose and the right thing, and the right set and setting.
Your cannabis is probably psychedelic.
I'm telling you, smoke it when you're by yourself and you're feeling good, and just tell me what voices you hear or what things you see. So this whole thing about what is it about MDMA that would heal this guy that you just talked about? And it just seems like the ability to remove all these conditioning.
There's make news again right now on your show.
You have to come more often here, Adam.
I was in Florida for Thanksgiving, and my mom asked me, "Have you tried MDMA?" And I'm not going to lie to my mom, and I said, "Yes, I have tried it. I've only tried it once." Okay, I'm at all this advocacy for MDMA. Attention DEA. I've only done it once.
I'm pretty clean.
Okay, I don't do it regularly. I don't microdose it. Like, I am not on MDMA now. Okay, but I did it once, and it was pure MDMA, and I had a lot of things to work out about my divorce that came up.
Yeah.
And it wasn't an easy experience. It wasn't exactly what I would call a club drug experience.
You weren't dancing.
No, it was like, I need to talk
probably
about
like
this.
Shedding
I need
a
to
lot
talk about
tears.
Some really hard. I was crying.
Yeah,
and it was. And I had to talk about some really hard stuff that happened during my divorce. And everybody who goes to divorce probably knows what I'm talking about. It's not easy. And so helped me process. And it was not intentional. Like, it was not in a therapeutic setting. And I wish it was. I think I would have been an even better experience. So.
Yeah, they're very powerful tools, and it's almost with where we're at right now on this planet with Trump, with climate change, with the rise of AI, with virtual reality about to hit us, with CRISPR and DNA editing. They're like China, the reports out of China is that they've already cloned humans now, and it's like, you know, it's already...
It's not cloning, it's immunity from HIV,
they've edited the genes of the human embryo, right?
I believe one of the twins doesn't have the immunity from HIV, and the other one does, and it's like you're comparing the twins and see how they do, which would help prove whether or not this technology is safe or not. I actually think the technology, if it could be proven safe and it can improve humanity's well-being,
it's the way we use it.
Well, here's the thing.
It's just the way we use it. It's how we regulate it. It's how we apply it. It's how we create access to it.
This is about to be in the conversation of the ethics around this. Okay, it's here. The technology is here. It's going to be used. So how do we use it responsibly, whatever that means?
The doctor who did this, I don't think was acting ethically, because you're supposed to publish proposals before you're supposed to publish your plans before you do it and seek critique.
Peer review.
Yeah, peer review before you even start the whole thing.
Too late.
And too late. And, you know, he's like, well, peer review wouldn't work because everyone would tell me not to do it.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. It's true.
And there have been examples in breakthroughs over the years where this has actually been the kind of response people have gotten to new ideas. So, you know, it's a tough call. And what I think, though, in general, is that there needs to be transparency about what's going on to everyone. The person, I mean, for instance, I mean, how much regulation is there of this 23andMe, you know, send off? Have you guys done that?
Bialetta has.
I didn't give them my information.
Well, she gave her saliva. So that's.
I gave my saliva, but I told them not to use publicly my information. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what they're doing.
So did you like the results?
She's asking OC Jew. Believe it or not, she looks like an Indian, but she's Jew.
I am like 80% Eskenazi Jew, and that was like, I always felt like I was a Jew that looked like Pocahontas, and I didn't understand a lot of things. So it was sort of, you know, just like, oh wow, yes. It gave me a little bit of understanding, and I met relatives, which is what, you know, it's a social media thing too, right? It's like a Facebook thing. It's like you hang out with relatives, and then you're like, oh well, maybe I don't like you. But now the first thing about Facebook is like you get together with those people that you haven't seen in years, and then you're like, oh well, maybe I don't want to hang out with you, or maybe I do, I don't know. So it's kind of the same thing, right? It's just meeting all these relatives, and then you decide
connected to their spit.
Yeah.
Reunited.
Yeah. So,
have you done 23andMe?
Well, I have the kit sitting on my desk right now.
So you were just filling questions.
I'm really curious. I think we're not talking about this That is a powerful thing that's going on right now. It's one of the most popular gifts for this holiday season.
Yeah, yeah.
It's finding out where your genes really are. So it's like I'm Ashkenazi Jew too. Even though I haven't been tested, I'm pretty sure I'm 100%. My mom and dad got tested. My daughter got tested. My daughter is officially, I think, 50.1% Ashkenazi Jew because, you know, her mom is not Ashkenazi Jew, but there must be a tiny bit in her side. Meanwhile, my dad and mom, my dad came in like at 99.7 and my mom was like 100%.
Wow.
Now, that 100% is what really bothered me. Now, seriously, how is anyone 100% of anything?
It's impossible.
From where they come from.
Genetically speaking.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, then it got me thinking, well, what do they mean by Ashkenazi Jew? And this is the gene that's the Ashkenazi Jew, and they're matching up. And then I thought, this is actually really scary shit.
Why?
Because they're attaching certain genes to certain ethnic identities and religious cultural identities.
Yeah.
And it's like, if the Nazis had this power, they would have used it to say, prove that you're a Jew. Huh. And they would have thrown you in the ovens, or they would have proved you're a Roma because they killed the Roma too. And or they would prove you're something else. But like,
well, if
or they just say you have a defective gene that we want to wipe out of the human race. Yeah, whatever
that,
it is.
That's true. But if that knowledge is legit, you're saying you don't think it's legit, right? You're saying your mother cannot be 100% Ashkenazi.
I'm saying that's 100% of what they understand Ashkenazi Jew to be, but there could be other genes. I mean, what about all the folks who, and I believe 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust. All of their genes are gone. So how do we know there aren't other genes?
Because
someone at the very beginning of 23andMe's, you know, classification of genes had to say, well, we know these are 100% Ashkenazi Jews. How do you know that? Well, they traced their lineage back 10 generations and we know where they lived and that's how they do it. So they find, like, we found some Peruvians that go back 10 generations. We found some Palestinians that go back 10 generations or British folks. And then they say, okay, now the mutts, all the mutts out there, they got little bits and pieces of these genes, but they don't have necessarily all the ethnic roots. I mean, how could they have it all, you know, and how could they really know where what an Ashkenazi Jew is? That's what I'm kind of say it is, because it's like, I want to let you know about the Kohen in Judaism, right?
No, I don't. So, I mean, you do. I didn't know. Like,
oh, okay, you converted. Oh, wait. So you didn't know it?
That's not 100% true. I mean, I knew that my father's side was Jewish, but my parents were like free thinkers, no religion attached.
Hippies down in Argentina.
I grew up very much like, you know, agnostic. You are yourself, and you'll decide one day. And we're not going to touch any religion or
so there was
any,
no orthodoxy like in her upbringing
there,
whatsoever.
There was nothing.
So that's fair enough. I mean, lots of Jews are raised without the religion.
It's more
about all the Jews in Russia. They were forbidden from practicing religion for 80 years.
Of course, yeah.
You know, but the one thing about the Kohen, okay, so...
the Kohen is that object that reflects...
This is the sign of the Kohen, which is like me making the Spock sign. Two Spocks come together, makes a pyramid. This is the sign of the Kohen, and these are the priests who ran the temple in ancient Israel for like 1,200 years. It was a class. They are the descendants of Aaron, who was the brother of Moses, and Aaron was like the spokesman for Moses because Moses couldn't really speak very well because he had a burnt tongue from his childhood when he reached for the hot coals instead of the golden objects, and that's a whole other story. Anyway... Aaron was like total PR director for Moses, okay? And he, like, they created the tabernacle, they had the Ten Commandments, and only the priests were allowed to even handle the Ten Commandments, okay? When the temple was destroyed, almost all the tribes of Israel were lost, except for the Israelites, the Levites, and the Kohen. And many of the Kohen went to an island off of Cyprus. They also went all over the world, sometimes with other Jewish refugees. And they kind of carried the Torah, you know. They kind of kept the book, the sacred books alive. But a few years ago, researchers figured out that there's actually a gene that passes from father to son, father to son, father to son, meaning it's from Aaron, that everyone, all the Kohen have.
Huh.
And 95% of the Kohen in the world that they tested had the gene. So there's some Kohen that are fakers, okay, that are not really related to this distant male father figure, which we believe is Aaron. So we can actually test Jews to find out if they're Kohen. And you know, I haven't been tested, but I'm a Kohen. And,
we'll
and it's
see
sort
about
of
that.
Like it's sort of like I don't want to be
are
one,
you really?
I don't want to be a faker. And but it's also like, you know, who does it really matter? You know, at a certain point I'm like, human rights are more important than whether or not my ancestors were working in the temple.
Human
in
rights
Jerusalem,
are definitely
you know?
More important, but there is something about where we come from that understand that, that help us
that
understand
is
who
why
we are.
Who we are today because of all the yeah, the generations.
Understanding as paired with we're all really related. I think
with
that's
we're
what,
all one. Yeah, I'm
I
with
want,
you.
I
well,
because
go back further in those genes from the Kohanes, yeah. And we're coming from the genes that were survived in Africa through the ice ages and through, I mean, the reductions and the famines and all that from the tribes out of Africa. Even
I think
much
so.
Further
I think it
back
all came out
that.
Of Africa too. I
yeah,
agree.
That's and, the rumor.
Hey. Yeah. So
what time is it?
I don't know. Man.
See, this is a great
which
conversation,
like,
guys.
Amazing.
Yeah. I'm
amazing.
Enjoying this.
Yeah. Yeah, so we don't have much time, but I want to ask you. I mean, you've done some incredible like civil disobedience acts, and you've been all over the news for that. But I think they're also creative and interesting. So I wanted to ask you about, you know, that one time that you gave free joints to congressional staffers on 420 and about the planting hemp seeds in the front lawn of the DA office. I mean, like, first of all, who comes up with these like, ideas? And you have some cojones. I mean, you do
every
have cojones.
Every single idea is David Bronner's idea.
How many times have you been arrested?
I take no responsibility for my actions.
No, these no. are like...
Actually, it's not true. he had the idea of digging up the DEA's front lawn, and he had the idea of locking himself in a steel cage in front of the White House with live cannabis plants while he harvested the plants, made hemp oil, and served it to the general public while the police tried to get him out of the steel cage for 3 hours. That was a cool idea, but... I had
when
the idea.
Do that one? I'm still waiting for that one.
He came up with this idea like 2 years before he did it. I mean,
just
he was like,
me, when you hatched that idea and that plan, just let me know, okay?
Well, it was like, we're working in a jail cell, and it was like, we have to build a jail cell on wheels.
What?
Yeah, I think the statute of limitations has passed on getting prosecuted, so I can talk about it. But it was like, it was a team effort, and some great welders in Asheville, North Carolina, like built this a beautiful, hard to get into jail cell, and David Bronner locked himself in it, and I was on the support team, but that support team was risky. And but no, I believe in civil disobedience. I believe in direct action. I think sometimes you have to break the law. Keep it peaceful. Keep it nonviolent. Be smart about it. Don't piss more people off than you inspire. If you're pissing more people off than you inspire, then just don't do it. But if you're inspiring more people than you're pissing off, then you should do it. Like, just about 2 months ago, helped organize, I didn't do it though, Rachel Donlin and Chris Furnish and this whole team of DCMJ and MDMJ activists, about 20 of us, went to Andy Harris's office, demanded a meeting after multiple written letters requesting me, they're never going to give us a meeting. So they just smoked cannabis right in front of his office on Capitol Hill in the Longworth House office building. Shut the whole freaking floor down. I mean, they like the police had the whole place shut down. Then they did an overdose, which was basically a die-in. They laid on the ground like they were dead, and then we had prescription drug bottles, and we had made it look like they were actually doing an overdose on opioids. But this whole protest, they got arrested, and you know, in the end, the charges were dropped. Like, there's no charge. I mean, it was over an hour of like nonstop social media that she's still on the floor, and like, you know, the paramedics came and they weren't sure if it really was an overdose because like they just smoked cannabis, and like it was like, you can't overdose on cannabis, guys. You know, that was the whole point. It was like, this was.
But it's a Schedule One.
But it was quite serious protest at times. Like, we read memorials to their friends because they each had friends who died from opioid overdoses and recently. And we're still processing all this, that these close friends had just suddenly died because of prescription drugs, and which are supposedly safe enough to give people. And, you know, it was powerful protest. When we did the joint giveaway at Trump's inauguration, DuPont Circle, we used that same jail cell.
And you had this huge joint, right? I mean, the prop, right? Like marching down the street.
Well, that was a different occasion, but we gave away 10,000 joints at Trump's inauguration. We invited Republicans. We said, come, it's legal in D.C. for us to give you a joint. We really want to get off on the right foot. This is kind of weird that he's the president, but maybe we should put our energy out there that we're not hating on you from day one. I didn't agree with the protests on day one of Donald Trump. I'm going to put that out there. I have good friends who organized them, actually.
Did the whole, the Women's March?
I stand in solidarity with their prosecutions.
The J-20,
the so-called
right?
J-20.
Yeah, yeah.
Disrupt J-20. I think they were right to have, they have every right to free speech and everything, but you know, I don't think that protest actually won over people. I think it strengthened the Trump supporters. It gave them more cause.
It.
And it made it was sort of like, you know, the burning of a limousine, which happened to be owned by like a, you know, by the driver. It wasn't like it was owned by Oprah or something. And you know, or that's a bad example.
Oprah?
Kennedy.
How dare you?
And, no, actually, my understanding is that limo was for Oprah, but it was a hired driver. But anyway, I feel bad that they were prosecuted. They had the book thrown at them. I stood in solidarity with them after the fact, but. The protest itself, I felt like, was totally tone deaf to where everybody was. We had just had an election. It wasn't disputed anymore. He's becoming president. Obama's leaving office willingly. Can we just have a day of unity? You know, and unity is like where you have to like sit down with someone you totally don't agree with, but you can tolerate them.
It's the only way that we're going to heal as a country.
And we smoke a joint together. And we even, there was a march from that giveaway to the inauguration to watch the swearing in. And I kid you not, there were black bloc anarchists with bandanas on, wearing all black, waving their anarchist flag next to Trump supporters, smoking joints, walking down the street like this is great. And everybody got it. Like 1,000 people got it, that this was, you know, this was a unifying thing, and that we weren't there to protest Trump. We were there to send a message to Trump that we're here, we're a constituency, you should talk to us. I was saying the same thing to Obama. You mentioned the inflatable. Cesar Maxit, the local artist, who I have to give him 100% credit, designed a 51-foot inflatable joint that said, Obama, deschedule cannabis now. And later, we built a second one, and it said, Hillary, deschedule cannabis now. And then we built a third one, another 51-footer, and it said, burned by the DNC. And we took it to the DNC. We actually brought two joints, because, you know, if you're going to the DNC, you're going to smoke two joints at the DNC.
Just to be able to stand there.
We had two 51-foot joints, like, marching down the street. Like, it was the largest demonstration at the Democratic National Convention. Over 5,000 people showed up. There's great aerial photos the police took of these massive joints. You can totally see these joints moving down the street from a helicopter. You know, like they're that big. And, you know, you'd have like 20 or 30 people underneath the joint holding it up. I mean, you could not hold this joint with less than 10 people. I mean, it was so big. And sorry, folks, it didn't smoke and it was just plastic inflatable, but it looked so real. And when we took it to the White House the first time, look up Naked Truth on Netflix, episode 5, if you want to see this. They literally like stopped us. Secret Service stopped us on the way in. And there was a standoff. It went on for like an hour. And eventually, we deflated the joint, rolled it up, went in, had our rally. Then at 4:20, suddenly the joint reappeared, but now it was right in front of the White House. This is like, and of course, Secret Service hated this because they have snipers and they want to be able to shoot everyone. So they couldn't see us anymore because we were hiding behind this huge joint. And like their Secret Service, like chasing our people around the park with this huge joint, like get out! And it was so, anyone there was like, oh my god, this is really
like a
living.
Monty Python.
Yeah, it was
situation.
Like it was like we were high as hell, being chased to the park with our giant joint, and then we did smoke. Nobody was arrested. We kind of called the bluff of the Secret Service. You know, we were like, you know what, you're gonna have to arrest like 150 of us right now. And the strength in numbers, and they're like, we're not going to arrest 150 stoners. That'll be on the front page of the news. It'll make Obama look bad. Well, we kept going back to the White House. We gave away live plants at the White House. We gave away seeds at the White House, over 10,000 seeds. And then we got a meeting with the White House. And the department, and they heard us out. It was a listening meeting. They weren't going to say anything. They're just going to listen. Because they were tired. I was like, well, you know, I'm glad you're listening, but we need to have a green ribbon panel. You need to invite the movement into the White House and then just listen some more. Stop. I just told Meryl Bowser the same thing. I was like, and through the media, of course, because she doesn't actually pick up the phone and call me, which she should do. And
bring.
She really should. She should just talk to me instead of springing things. Oh, she springs things on me all the time. Like she, I didn't know that she was going to change the police policy to not arresting people in public for smoking and instead make it a $25 citation. Great. Why don't you work with me on that? That's what we've been fighting for all this time. But no, we do all this like public work. We get the public all jazzed up. And then when it's convenient for her, the day after she loses an election, I mean her independent she picked loses the election. I'm talking about Redder, who she tried to replace Alyssa Silverman with. You know, the day after, she doesn't want to talk about losing, even though she won the mayor's seat back. Just congratulations, by the way. She's upset. Everyone's like, oh, you didn't get the council you wanted, you know? And it's like, all right, let's get everyone stop talking about that. We're going to legalize marijuana ASAP. And she's saying this for good reason, because Eleanor Holmes Norton is going to get the rider removed. We don't need to fight Andy Harris anymore. Like, he's not the focus.
So is that...
The focus is our own Congress.
So now, tell me this. When can I open up a coffee shop where you can buy and smoke?
That's 2020.
Okay.
If David Grosso puts forth the legislation he's already introduced, he just puts it forth when he's lawfully able to introduce it, and we can have a hearing and we can have a vote. I think 2020, and I think what you have to look out for are people like Chairman Mendelson, who is just not a friend to cannabis. I'm sorry. He likes to portray himself that way. He's totally not. And he's not a friend to human rights. He's not a friend. I can't stand him. Like, I think he should not have been reelected. The public needs to we need to expose him, that he actually is a toll for the Republicans in Congress. And he's the no man in that council when it comes to everything I propose. And I'm tired of it. So, you know, Jack Evans is a good guy on cannabis. You know, he's not good on a lot of issues, but he's actually pretty... he gave cannabis to his dying wife like 15 years ago. Brianna Doe is really good. He represents the line here in Ward 1. I think she'll do good by us. We have a lot of allies, more allies than enemies, I would say, on cannabis in the council. So pass a good bill. But first, since we can't do anything until 2019 when the rider expires, have a listening tour. Go to every neighborhood. This is what I'm telling the mayor. Go to every neighborhood. Hear everybody out. Don't form an opinion until you hear everyone out. Because once you hear everyone out, I think you'll realize that people aren't looking for a pot shop model. We're looking for...
Except for Rob.
A retail model that... It,
well, I still...
Well, I mean, I want pot shops, no, but I no, want I'm to be... I want like you to be able to go to Yes and buy cannabis and Yes. Like, I think you should be able to go to a supermarket. Anywhere that sells alcohol, you should be able to sell it. If it's a retail establishment, I think you should be able to buy it at gas stations. Why are we picking the winners and saying only a licensed seller?
Well, yeah, that's like a deep answer right there, right? For like dealing with money, prison industrial complex,
yeah, it's not fair
untraceable
to consumers.
Money. Yeah, I mean, it's like that whole reefer madness and all the reasons of why it's illegal and why it's kept illegal, et cetera. That's like a very complex, deep problem that goes way back in our history.
I mean, sugar is more deadly.
Oh, yeah.
than cannabis. And we don't limit the number of points of sale.
White
sugar.
Sugar, red meat, alcohol.
Yeah, there's all these things that we just take for granted that there are things you can
Once again,
get,
because we don't push back on it. We don't push back on the message. And what's really interesting right now that's happening is, because the message was always kind of centrally owned with the networks and ABC, NBC, CBS, etc., with now the rise of social media, with now the rise of smart devices in everybody's hand, that's completely fragmented that message, and it is non-hierarchical, and that's why everything's in disarray right now. I mean, that's a big reason. I think it's like trying to come to terms with that new way of communication right now, and where is it going? And it seems very chaotic at the moment with a lot of long-standing institutions and feeling that pressure and a bit crumbling. It's really interesting to see where all this ends up with everything that's happening right now and just now emerging.
But that's for another show, Rob.
Oh, we could go so far, so deep, and so long.
I know.
But
Alexia
has to
work.
Have we hit the bottom of the rabbit hole here?
No, I haven't even scratched it.
We haven't.
I haven't
even
seen the fucking rabbit.
But we got to end the show.
We'll have you back, Adam.
That's what I meant.
Right round there. Two.
You got to come back.
I like it here.
Yeah, it's
a good,
it's a cool space.
Cozy studio space.
Yeah.
We were talking to Adam Eidenberg. Thank you so much for being here. Yeah.
Welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming. You know,
activist and organizer
what time
of
is it?
All good causes here.
Just a last little... story. When we were going to sell, you know, we're selling now pints in supermarkets, natural food stores, and so I had to go to the food show, and I hate going to food shows. I never did go to any of those. So my first food show that I had to go set up a stand, a natural food show, was Baltimore Expo East. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I'm up there, and I was like, yeah, fuck this. And so, you know, it's really interesting because the people that would come to our table and I'd talk about, I ended up talking more about psychedelics and this stuff than I did about gelato and coffee. And the last day, I think it was, I was down trying to fight a charge that they get. And I looked over and I see Adam, and I'm like, oh, we want to get him on our show. So I walked over and said, Adam, hey, I'm Rob from Dolcezza, man. We would love to have you on our show. And Adam was like, yeah, that's cool. Yeah, we could do it. And he's like, you want to smoke a joint? And so we go out on the Baltimore Convention Center steps and smoked a joint. And it's like, I love these natural food shows, man. They're like great, you know? So I'm
thank
glad.
You for
full
making
circle.
Rob change his view.
Yeah, I'm
a little
natural
bit
food
on,
show all the yes. way now. So thanks,
oh,
Adam,
well,
for that.
We'll need Adam on the next one.
Yes, yeah. We shall. Thanks, yeah. man.
Thank you, Adam,
I
again.
Appreciate being here.
See you around.
Yeah. Take care, and thank you. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.